Last night was supposed to be the most predictable night in Washington.
Yeah, usually it's incredibly scripted.
Exactly. I mean, the White House Correspondents' Dinner, it's this evening of, highly engineered inside the beltway roasting.
Right, everyone puts on tuxedos and pretends to be friends for a few hours.
Yeah, politicians and journalists trading these very mild focus group barbs. But last night at the Waldorf Astoria, that whole precision machinery just completely broke down.
It really did. It shattered, honestly.
Like, instead of a standard roast, we ended up watching a former president stand in front of his greatest critics and just, well, systematically tear up his own script.
Yeah, in a room that was still heavily shadowed by a near-fatal shooting that happened just 3 months prior, let's not forget.
Right. And what we got was this hour-long speech that morphed into this surreal, like, live airing of
Of
grievances.
course, a literal constitutional provocation.
And this massive proxy war over the role of comedy in American politics. It was a lot.
It was a total collision of political and cultural tectonic plates, happening in real time. We're looking at an event that fundamentally breaks all the rules of whatever genre it's even supposed to belong to.
And so that is our mission for you today on this deep dive. We are unpacking this highly unusual, totally charged event that just took place on July 24,
We
2027.
really want to get into the raw facts, right?
Exactly. We are extracting the facts, the mechanics, and those underlying tensions of the dinner, but without the partisan spin. We want to map out, like, not just what happened, but the actual architecture of how it happened.
And why the media reactions to it fractured so violently this morning.
Yes. So to map that terrain accurately, we're pulling from this specialized tracking project. It's titled the Trump Dossier 2015-2029.
Which is a fantastic resource because it aggregates reports from a really vast, incredibly diverse spectrum of media outlets.
It's not just one angle.
Right. The stack of reporting we're analyzing includes CNN, ABC News, NPR, Fox News, Twitchy, Variety, NBC Boston, and Al Jazeera.
It's a very comprehensive cross-section of the whole media ecosystem,
It really is.
which actually brings us to the most crucial piece of groundwork before we even start. And this is important. We have a strict neutrality disclaimer for you.
Because we are looking at highly polarized reactions here from left-leaning, right-leaning, and centrist outlets.
Right. So our job today is to act entirely as your guides to this source material. We are taking absolutely no sides here.
None at all.
We are not endorsing the viewpoints of these outlets or the commentators or the speakers involved. We are simply, conveying the ideas, the quotes, and the arguments exactly as they are contained in the reporting.
We're just here to dismantle the machinery of the messaging, really, just to see how the gears turn.
Because understanding the modern political landscape requires looking at the blueprints of these events, dispassionately.
You really have to analyze the structural engineering of a political moment, regardless of how you might personally feel about the politician at the podium.
So let's start with the physical and psychological architecture of the room itself, before anyone even stepped up to the
Yeah,
microphone.
the atmosphere.
Right. Because the defining context of last night's dinner is that it was a rescheduled event. The original dinner, which was planned for 3 months ago, was abruptly canceled when shots were actually fired.
And that is a staggering, I mean, almost impossible shadow to have hanging over what is ostensibly a comedy show.
Right. It's so heavy.
Think about just the baseline psychology of a normal comedy club.
Okay, yeah.
The room requires a certain foundation of safety to allow for the tension and release of humor, right? You have to feel safe to laugh.
You do.
But last night, you had a room full of journalists, politicians, and celebrities who, in that exact context, just 3 months prior, were plunged into this terrifying, life-threatening
So
situation.
the baseline tension in that ballroom wasn't like comedic anticipation, it was existential memory.
Exactly. And according to ABC News, Trump tackled that shadow the literal second he opened his mouth.
Wow, right away.
Yeah, his opening remark referenced the canceled event directly. He said, and I quote, "As I said 3 months ago, the show must go on." And then he looked out at the room, acknowledged that most of the attendees had experienced a period of trauma, and he noted that some people were actually afraid to attend.
Which is very blunt.
It is. And then he praised the people sitting there for showing up anyway.
Okay, analytically, look at the psychological pivot he executes in those first 30 seconds.
Yeah, break that down.
He acknowledges the shared, horrifying reality, right? But he instantly reframes it into a test of strength.
Like some people were afraid, but you weren't.
Exactly. He is bonding himself and the audience together in this shared resilience. It anchors the room in a very somber, serious reality.
It establishes this dynamic where he's basically validating their courage before he pivots to the entertainment portion.
Right. But that somber, validating anchor is in violent contrast with how his own administration previewed the event.
Oh, the preview was wild.
This detail from ABC7 New York is where the strategy starts to look incredibly bizarre to me. The White House actually released an official preview of the speech beforehand, announcing to the press that the address would be, quote, unifying but vicious.
The deployment of a deliberate oxymoron.
I mean, it's like a boxing promoter handing you a ticket and promising, hey, tonight you will experience a warm, gentle hug followed immediately by a devastating uppercut.
It makes no sense on the surface.
How does a speaker even attempt to deliver on a prompt that contradicts itself so completely? It feels like a terrible PR strategy, right? Just confusing your audience before you even arrive.
Well, it only looks like terrible PR if you assume the goal is traditional political communication.
Okay, fair point.
If we analyze his communication style through a wider lens, that oxymoron is a highly calibrated strategy of disorientation.
Disorientation, right.
Think about audience psychology for a second. If a politician announces they will be purely unifying, the audience relaxes, right? They lean back in their chairs.
Sure, they expect something boring and nice.
Exactly. But if they announce they will be vicious, the audience puts their guard up and braces for impact.
They get defensive.
Right. So by promising both simultaneously, you essentially strip the audience of their predictive models. You keep them entirely off balance.
Wow. Okay. So it lowers their guard while simultaneously issuing a threat.
Yes. Nobody in the room knows which version of the speaker they will get from sentence to sentence. It commands absolute hyper-vigilant attention because it is intrinsically unpredictable.
It's a suspense mechanism. So the room is carrying this three-month-old trauma. They've been promised this disorienting emotional whiplash. They sit through a long preamble award ceremony, which featured CNN's Wolf Blitzer, by the way. And then finally he enters.
And the entrance is where it starts.
Right. Al Jazeera reports he received polite standard applause upon walking in. And his immediate icebreaker to the journalist, who literally just clapped for him.
What did he say?
He quips, "This is the largest gathering of people with Trump derangement syndrome."
Wow. He delivers on the unifying but vicious promise within like 10 seconds.
Yep.
He is physically in the room with them, which is the unifying part, but immediately attacks their psychological state, which is the vicious part.
It sets an incredibly tense tone right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
But the reporting shows that the friction didn't just stay between the speaker and the press corps.
No, it got much weirder structurally.
The most fascinating mechanical breakdown of the night was how the actual hour-long performance unfolded on that stage.
Right, the teleprompter situation?
Yes. CNN reported a highly unusual dynamic. Trump was openly criticizing his own speechwriters while reading their jokes.
While he was reading them.
Yeah, like he appeared visibly annoyed at the material rolling on the prompter in real time.
Which fundamentally breaks the fourth wall of political speechmaking.
It really does.
Traditionally, the politician and the teleprompter operate as a unified, seamless entity. Like, the unspoken social contract of a political address is that the words on the screen represent the politician's organic thoughts.
Even if everyone in the room knows a team of writers spent 3 weeks agonizing over every single comma, we all pretend it's off the cuff.
Exactly. We all play along.
So breaking that contract is so jarring. It's like watching a stage actor stop mid-soliloquy, glare at the audience, and complain about the playwright's dialogue.
It's very meta.
But I have to push back a little on the idea that this is just some strategic masterstroke. Like, could it just be a failure of preparation?
How do you mean?
Well, if he didn't read the jokes beforehand, and he genuinely hates them in the moment, isn't he just sabotaging his own event out of pure frustration?
It certainly involves a degree of impulse, I'll leave you that. But whether premeditated or reactive, it functions as a highly effective dominance display.
Dominance over his own staff.
Exactly. By throwing his own speechwriters under the bus in real time, he severs his connection to the polished, prepackaged Washington machine.
Huh.
He is essentially communicating to the room, look, I am up here suffering through these terrible jokes just like you are.
Oh, that's clever. It forces a bizarre solidarity with the audience at the expense of his writers.
Yes. And furthermore, it creates an impenetrable defense mechanism for him.
Because if a joke fails to land, he isn't done funny. His writers are just incompetent.
Precisely. He absorbs all the credit for any laughs and immediately deflects all the blame for the silence.
And man, there was plenty of silence to deflect, apparently. NBC Boston tracked the shifting vibe of the room chronologically, and their reporting paints a picture of, well, a balloon slowly deflating.
Which is painful at a comedy dinner.
Very. What began as friendly, receptive laughter gradually devolved into scattered, dull chuckles as the hour stretched on.
Yeah, an hour is a long time for that kind of tension.
The speech wildly alternated between a conciliatory tone toward the press and then launching these bitter, personalized insults. The reception just grew decidedly cool.
And this is the inherent risk of relying on the disorientation strategy for an extended period.
Because it's exhausting.
Exactly. Emotional whiplash is engaging for 10 minutes. But over the course of an hour, it becomes physically draining. The audience cannot find a rhythm.
They can't relax.
They cannot settle into a predictable pattern of tension and release. So their natural defense mechanism is to simply check out. They stop reacting and start just enduring it.
Enduring the hour. And while the room was enduring, he delivered one highly specific, deeply layered joke that CNN flagged as particularly significant.
The CBS allegory.
Yes, it was an allegory aimed directly at CBS News. He referenced the new owner, Paramount's David Ellison, and the editor-in-chief, Barry Weiss. But the punchline was framed in a very specific, frankly aggressive way.
What was the exact phrasing again?
He claimed that a, quote, once feared regime that attacked America was finally brought down.
I mean, the linguistic choices there are just extraordinary. Regime. Attacked America. Brought down.
I read that in the dossier and immediately thought, okay, we have left the realm of a corporate merger joke.
We are miles away from a corporate joke.
CNN analyzed this not as inside baseball media commentary, but as a thinly veiled declaration of victory in his longstanding war against the traditional press.
He is translating corporate realities into the language of military conquest.
Right.
He isn't discussing market share or restructuring or boardroom dynamics. By using the word regime, he is stripping CBS of its status as a civic institution and recategorizing it as an authoritarian foreign power.
And framing them as an entity that, quote, attacked America, turns journalists into hostile combatants.
It fundamentally changes the stakes of the entire room.
Yeah, it's one thing to roast a news anchor for a bad rating. That's standard fare. It is entirely different to stand at a comedy dinner and equate corporate restructuring with a military victory over a hostile occupying force.
You can see exactly why NBC Boston reported those dull chuckles.
Yeah, the journalists in that room are essentially being asked to laugh at an allegory describing their own structural demise.
Exactly. When the underlying premise of the joke is that your profession is an enemy of the state that is finally being dismantled, the humor kind of evaporates.
Yeah, and it's not very funny to the target.
The joke functions as a signal to his supporters that a cultural enemy has been defeated, but to the people sitting there in tuxedos, it just sounds like an obituary.
That's a chilling way to put it. So as those written allegories failed to generate laughs, the structure of the speech collapsed into something much more raw.
The prompter was basically done at this point.
Right. The sources indicate the teleprompter material was essentially abandoned, and the speech pivoted into a sustained barrage of highly personalized attacks.
The grievance hit list.
The grievance hit list.
Yeah.
And if we categorize this list, the sheer chronological and cultural span of the targets is fascinating.
It really is. Let's break that down.
Let's start with the Hollywood and pop culture targets. The most extensive attack detailed in the Variety reporting was aimed at Bruce Springsteen.
The boss.
Yeah. Trump complained bitterly about Springsteen delivering, quote, four political speeches during a 3-hour concert.
Okay. Standard political critique so far.
Right. But then the critique abandoned politics entirely and got incredibly personal. He said, and I quote, what the hell happened to that guy? He looks like hell. I'm sure he doesn't like how I look, but I don't look that bad. He then suggested renaming the tour board in the USA and mocked one of Springsteen's new songs as terrible.
It's a complete rhetorical blitz, moving from a critique of civic engagement directly into visceral body shaming and artistic mockery.
And he just kept firing. He dismissed Rosie O'Donnell as a, quote, sick older woman.
Bringing up Rosie O'Donnell in 2026.
Right. He targeted late night hosts Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel. He even brought up Jane Fonda.
Jane Fonda.
Yes. And that pop culture list transitions directly into a political hit list that reads like a roster of his most prominent adversaries from the last 10 years.
Who is on the political side?
Former President Joe Biden, Democratic Senate Leader Chuck Schumer, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Adam Schiff, Representative Ilhan Omar, Governor Gavin Newsom, and former Governor Chris Christie.
A very comprehensive list of rivals.
And notably, he specifically made a point to enunciate the name Barack Hussein Obama.
Which is a critical detail in mapping the rhetorical terrain of the night. The inclusion of that specific nomenclature is never an accident.
No, and we must report how the sources evaluated that rhetoric. NPR explicitly noted in their coverage that some of his remarks, alongside the use of these specific recycled nicknames, bordered on racism.
And maintaining our strict neutrality, we want to emphasize that is NPR's direct assessment of the language used in that ballroom.
Exactly. It's also important to note that the reporting showed the dust was still settling the next morning. There hadn't been immediate widespread public reactions from targets like Representative Omar or Chris Christie at the time these sources were compiled.
But if we look at the totality of that list, Springsteen, O'Donnell, Fonda, Obama, Schiff, Warren, a very specific pattern emerges regarding how he utilizes cultural figures.
I see the pattern, but honestly, it feels so incredibly dated to me.
How so?
It feels like a Grievance Greatest Hits album from a decade ago. Why is the former president of the United States bringing up Jane Fonda or Rosie O'Donnell in 2026?
It does seem random at first glance.
Is there an actual strategic value to keeping these ancient feuds alive, or is it just a lack of new material?
It's definitely not a lack of material. It's a reliance on established emotional shortcuts.
Okay, explain that.
To understand the utility of this hit list, you have to recognize that within his political movement, these individuals are no longer just people. They have been elevated into permanent archetypes.
Oh, I see. It's like using their names as ghosts to scare up old culture war feelings.
That is an excellent way to frame it. When he attacks Jane Fonda, he is not offering commentary on whatever the actual Jane Fonda is doing in 2026.
Wait, but she's not driving the current news cycle.
No. But he is invoking the archetype of the Hollywood liberal elite, the anti-war movement, and the cultural upheaval of the 1960s and 70s that a specific demographic of his base deeply, deeply resents.
That makes a lot of sense.
And when he attacks Bruce Springsteen, a man whose brand is basically built on working-class American identity, but who aligns with Democratic politics, he is attacking the archetype of the working-class traitor.
Right, he's a symbol.
And Rosie O'Donnell functions as the archetype of the antagonistic progressive celebrity.
So they aren't targets at all. They are signals.
Precisely. It is incredibly efficient shorthand. Attacking them signals immediate ideological purity to his base.
It does not matter if the feud is currently dominating the news cycle.
Not even a little bit. Playing the greatest hits activates the exact same neural pathways of grievance, nostalgia, and tribal loyalty that fueled his earlier campaigns.
It reminds his audience exactly who the historical enemies are.
And it reaffirms his unique position as the only figure willing to stand at a microphone and insult them to their faces.
That makes the scattershot nature of the attack suddenly look incredibly cohesive when you view it like that.
It's very calculated.
But while many of those names were just rhetorical ghosts, one specific joke aimed at a very active current political rival sparked a microdrama that, to me, reveals something profound about the modern media ecosystem.
Ah, yes. The clash with California Governor Gavin Newsom.
Yes. This is arguably the most complex and revealing narrative thread in the entire dossier we reviewed.
It really forces us to examine the actual currency of public trust.
Right. So to understand why this interaction exploded the way it did, we have to rewind the clock 3 months right back to the days leading up to the original canceled dinner. Let's establish that context.
The Jimmy Kimmel incident.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jimmy Kimmel, who was one of the late night hosts targeted in last night's hit list, had aired a highly controversial sketch 3 months ago.
Right before the first dinner was supposed to happen.
Right. And in it, Kimmel made a joke stating that the first lady, quote, glowed like an expectant widow.
Which is a remarkably dark, provocative line that really crosses traditional boundaries of political satire.
Very dark. And the Trump administration treated it as a severe boundary violation. Fox News reported that the administration fiercely condemned the sketch, calling it corrosive and officially labeling it a, quote, call to violence.
Yeah. Notice the escalation in that rhetoric, by the way.
Yeah.
They did not just call it a joke in poor taste. They categorized a comedian's monologue as a literal threat to physical safety.
And this is where Gavin Newsom stepped into the fray. 3 months ago, Newsom fired back at the administration's reaction to Kimmel.
He went on the defensive for the comedians.
Yes. He accused the president of exploiting the subsequent shooting at the dinner to attack political opponents rather than attempting to unite the country. But the core of Newsom's defense was this deeply philosophical argument about the nature of comedy itself.
It was a fascinating argument.
He framed the administration's anger at Jimmy Kimmel not just as political whining, but as a fundamental attack on free speech. And his central thesis statement was this: they go after comedians because comedians are trusted.
That is a staggering claim from a sitting governor. Comedians are trusted.
It's wild when you think about it.
Newsom is essentially offering a devastating critique of his own profession. He is arguing that traditional politicians have entirely squandered the trust of the American public and that late-night hosts and satirists have inherited it.
He's basically arguing that the public views a late-night joke as a more honest critique than a policy white paper. So we hold that thesis in our minds and fast forward to last night. Trump is at the podium. He targets Newsom with a highly specific, localized joke.
He brings up the fire quotes.
Yeah, he references Newsom's recent public statements about needing to, quote, fight fire with fire in the political arena. But Trump punches back by saying, we know one thing about Gavin, he doesn't want to fight fire with water.
It's a very sharp, targeted jab at the widespread criticism of Newsom's handling of the devastating California wildfires.
It really is.
It uses Newsom's own rhetorical metaphor against a very painful, very real governance issue in his state.
And the sources confirmed the joke actually worked in the room, or at least with his base. Twitchy, the right-wing aggregator, reported that conservative media considered the joke spot on. It was an effective hit.
But the fascinating part isn't the joke itself, it's the aftermath.
Right. Twitchy reports that Newsom's team simply could not resist responding to it online. And their attempt to counter the joke reportedly backfired completely, with the source explicitly describing the response as a massive cell phone.
They walked right into the trap.
They really did. And this sequence of events is a flawless case study in how modern political media traps operate.
It is textbook.
But this is what I don't understand. Maybe you can help me here. Newsom's team is sophisticated, right?
Very.
They know Trump operates as a provocateur whose primary goal is to generate friction. Why is it so impossible for a seasoned political operation to just ignore a roast joke at a comedy dinner? Why did they feel compelled to engage at all?
Well, to understand their failure, you have to look back at Newsom's own thesis from 3 months prior.
The comedians are trusted thing.
Yes. He laid out his core belief. Comedians are trusted. If Gavin Newsom genuinely believes that comedy is the dominant vehicle for establishing truth in the public square, if he believes that a comedian shapes public perception more effectively than a politician, then a joke that successfully lands against him is not a minor annoyance.
It's dangerous.
To him, it is an existential threat to his political viability.
Oh, that is fascinating. Because even though Trump is a political rival, in the context of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, Trump is occupying the role of the comedian.
Exactly. Trump is wielding the exact weapon Newsom previously identified as the most trusted tool in modern media.
Wow.
If Newsom's team believes comedy dictates public reality, they cannot allow an effective joke to go unanswered. They feel an overwhelming strategic compulsion to counter-program the narrative.
But by engaging, they trigger a massive Streisand effect.
Precisely.
By trying to extinguish the joke, they just pour gasoline all over it. They take a punchline that was heard by a few million people watching C-SPAN, and they broadcast it to tens of millions of people across every single social media platform.
They legitimize the premise of the joke by taking it seriously enough to fight back.
Mm.
By issuing a response, they confirm that the punchline drew blood.
It is the ultimate weaponization of comedy.
And Newsom's team proved exactly how effective it is by failing to navigate it properly.
That proxy war over comedy was intense, but it wasn't the final boundary pushed during the hour. As the speech drew to a close, Trump executed a maneuver that pushed a very literal constitutional boundary.
Yeah, this was the moment that really broke the internet.
Let's examine the grand finale, the 2028 stunt.
The hat.
The hat, the climax of the address. Trump is wrapping up his remarks and he begins to joke about running for a third term in office. And then he physically produces and puts on a red hat emblazoned with the words Trump 2028.
A very visual provocation.
Now, I want to pause here and explicitly remind our listeners of the factual legal context, as firmly reported by ABC News in our dossier. A third presidential term is constitutionally forbidden by the 22nd Amendment of the United States.
It is not legally permissible, period.
Right.
Which is precisely the constraint that makes the stunt such a brilliant piece of media manipulation.
See, I wonder about that. Is it a brilliant manipulation, or are we overanalyzing a simple prop gag? Couldn't it just be an impulse to get a cheer from his supporters in the room?
The intention behind it almost doesn't matter, honestly, because the mechanical outcome is identical either way.
How so?
It forces the media ecosystem into a completely unwinnable situation. When he puts on a hat suggesting an unconstitutional third term at a comedy roast, he is daring the press to cover it.
Right.
Think about it. How does a legacy media organization respond to that visual?
Well, if they ignore it, they feel they are failing their civic duty to report on a potential authoritarian signal.
Exactly. They feel compelled to act as the guardians of democratic norms. They have to call it out.
But if they do report on it, if, say, ABC News publishes an earnest article fact-checking a prop hat at a comedy dinner, complete with legal analysis of the 22nd Amendment, the media instantly appears humorless, pedantic, and utterly hysterical to Trump's base.
Exactly. He forces the press to act like the fun police.
He traps them into responding to a joke with a legal brief.
Yeah.
Precisely. It delegitimizes the media's critical function by forcing them to expend their credibility fact-checking a stunt. It makes the press look out of touch with everyday human interaction, where a joke is just a joke.
It's a flawless win-win for his media strategy.
It really is. And on a secondary level, while the press is busy hyperventilating over the constitutional implications, he is successfully planting the seed of the idea, a third term, into the minds of his most ardent supporters.
He is normalizing a constitutionally forbidden concept under the impenetrable shield of humor.
Yes. And the success of that trap becomes blaringly obvious when you look at the fractured media fallout the very next morning.
Oh, the morning after reaction is profoundly jarring in the sources.
It really is.
It's like a prism taking a single beam of light, the event itself, and fracturing it into two completely isolated, incompatible realities.
Two separate dimensions of coverage that literally do not interact with one another.
Let's trace that split because it's wild.
Mm-hmm.
On one side of the prism, you have CNN. Brian Stelter is quoted in the dossier claiming the entire speech totally flopped.
A complete failure, according to him.
Yeah, he highlights the unfunny fat jokes, the recycling of stale grievances, and he argues vehemently that the president's rhetoric is actively responsible for destroying public trust in the media.
That represents the structural critique, the framing of the event as a tragic degradation of civic institutions.
Right. But then you step to the other side of the prism. You look at the right-wing commentators, heavily featured by Twitchy.
And what are they saying?
They don't just disagree with Stelter's critique. They completely reframe it as evidence of their own worldview.
Right.
They wave off the criticism and frame Stelter's reaction as absolute proof of the media's complete lack of self-reflection.
Yeah.
They view the media's outrage over the speech as the ultimate justification for why the attacks were necessary in the first place.
This is the mechanics of the modern echo chamber functioning at absolute peak efficiency.
But as a listener, and as a consumer of news, it is so deeply disorienting.
It has to be.
One side sees a dangerous, unfunny authoritarian actively damaging the republic. The other side sees a triumphant hero ruthlessly exposing the hypocrisy of a humorless elite establishment. How does a citizen even begin to process an event when the resulting realities are this divorced from one another?
Well, if we synthesize all the sources and connect this back to the core mission of our deep dive today, the most crucial liberating insight you can take away is this. The event itself almost doesn't matter.
Wait, the hour-long speech doesn't matter.
The physical reality of the event, the timing of the jokes, whether the applause was scattered or roaring, the awkward silences, the physical red hat, that is all secondary data.
Okay, then what is the primary data?
What truly matters is that the event provided the necessary raw material for the opposing echo chambers to reinforce their pre-existing narratives.
The dinner wasn't an event, it was a harvesting operation.
Exactly. CNN needed Trump to be offensive, unfunny, and threatening to reinforce their established narrative that he is a chaotic force destroying civic trust. Twitchy and the conservative media apparatus needed CNN to be outraged, pedantic, and humorless to reinforce their established narrative that the media is a hysterical, out-of-touch elite.
So they both got exactly what they wanted.
Yes. Last night's dinner functioned perfectly because it handed both sides exactly the footage, the quotes, and the friction they needed to keep their respective audiences angry, engaged, and clicking.
Neither side is attempting to convince the other of anything.
Not at all. They are simply harvesting the raw material of the event to feed their own enclosed ecosystems.
Wow. Let's just take a breath and unpack the immense ground we've covered today.
It's been a lot.
We started in a ballroom, heavy with the lingering, unhealed trauma of a near-fatal shooting. We watched a speaker deploy a unifying but vicious preview to strip an audience of their predictive defenses.
And then systematically break the fourth wall of political speechwriting to establish dominance over his own staff.
Right. We traced how a barrage of attacks against figures like Bruce Springsteen and Jane Fonda wasn't about the individuals, but about using their names as ghosts to summon historical culture war grievances.
And we saw a literal proxy war over comedy play out,
where Gavin Newsom's team stepped right into a catastrophic Streisand effect because they believed a roast joke was an existential threat to public trust.
And it culminated with a constitutional troll, a red 2028 hat, that perfectly fractured the media landscape into two entirely separate self-sustaining realities.
It is a chaotic, turbulent spectacle, for sure.
Yeah.
But it possesses a very distinct observable architecture once you understand the mechanics of the machinery.
And that understanding is exactly why this deep dive matters to you.
Absolutely. Whether you are prepping to debate these events, trying to understand the latest viral outrage cycle, or just attempting to navigate your daily newsfeed without losing your sanity, understanding how these events are constructed is vital.
It really is.
Understanding how the disorientation traps are laid, how the archetypes are deployed, and how the echo chambers harvest the friction. That is a superpower against information overload.
It elevates you from being a passive consumer of political theater to an active, critical decoder of the landscape.
It allows you to see the blueprint of the building rather than just reacting to the noise of the construction.
In a media environment defined by polarization, that critical distance is basically an essential survival skill.
Well said. We always want to leave you with a final thought, a provocation based on the source material to mull over on your own as you navigate the news this week.
And looking at the philosophical core of this entire event, there is a profound contradiction regarding who we actually trust.
The contradiction centers entirely around Gavin Newsom's thesis. He fiercely defended Jimmy Kimmel and the late-night comedians by arguing that they are under constant attack by political forces because, unlike traditional politicians, comedians are actually trusted by the American public.
They are perceived as the ultimate truth-tellers in a cynical age.
So, if we accept that premise, if the broader public has truly decided that the only people left to trust are the comedians and the provocateurs, what does that mean for the roomful of traditional, serious journalists who were sitting at those tables at the Waldorf Astoria last night?
That's the real question.
They spend the entire evening in awkward silence, being mocked by the speaker, while their structural demise was framed as a punchline. If the comedians hold the trust, what exactly is the role of the journalist left sitting in the dark, being laughed at by both sides?
It's something to think about.
We will leave you to ponder that one. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.